The show is Stand to Reason, friends. Greg Kokel, your host. And I was just thinking about how odd it is, and I've had this thought many, many, many times before. We just finished the first hour of the week. And, of course, you know we record these back-to-back, even though we send these out days apart, the podcasts. But the conversation that I had with our last caller was, I drew from something that I had read in 1 Timothy. But here's the odd thing. I just read that today on the airplane, I think, or last night before I was going to bed or something. What's odd is it's absolutely uncanny how often I will read something from, it does not matter where. I could be like in the last few lines of Hosea or something, and by golly, that's what I needed for this circumstance or that question or this call. It fits right in. This happens all the time. And I'm not like following any voices or anything, and God isn't telling me where to read and all of that kind of stuff. You know my views on that. But it just shows, though, the sovereign hand of God. I don't think these things happen by accident. And it's one of the reasons that, and I want to emphasize this as long as I'm here, in other words, on this topic, it's one of the reasons that I try to stay regularly in the Word, working from beginning to the end through the whole thing. Now, I've said this before. I've got my little checkbox list of this one is Book at a Time Bible Reading Plan. You could use all kinds of different ones. Just they're designed to get you bit by bit through the whole Bible. And most of these plans are for a year, but it takes me 3 years to get through them. But at the end of the 3 years, I'm through it, and I start over. So I am always working through the whole thing. Why do I do that? Because I'm a disciple of Jesus of Nazareth. This is the way we live. This is the book about reality. This tells us what's true about God and His world, things that we could never know otherwise, a lot of things we can figure out on our own. Because God's given us the faculties that allows us to do that. But a lot of things, we just need to hear from Him. Nobody can know the mind of a man except for the spirit of a man that's in him. And in the same way, Paul says, nobody can know the mind of God except for the spirit of God that's in him, or to any of those who he wants to reveal himself to. And that's why we have Scripture. That's his point there in the opening chapters of 1 Corinthians. So anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting. By the way, last chance here for me to mention, Unbelievable Live in L.A. this weekend. That is Friday, October 11th, and Saturday, October 12th. Friday, the big conversation between John Lennox and Dave Rubin. Of course, Unbelievable, question mark, is the title of a radio show that Justin Brierley does in the U.K. And every now and again, he'll come to the States, and especially West Coast, and do a version of it out here with a conference. And I've been to these before. They're fabulous. So I highly recommend it. It's going to be at Calvary Chapel in Costa Mesa. I think those seats are still warm from the nearly 2,700 people that we had there a week and a half ago, almost 2 weeks ago now, as you're hearing this, would be 2 weeks ago, with Rethink. And so this event that evening, Friday evening, the 11th, and then all day Saturday, the Unbelievable Conference, featuring not only John Lennox of Oxford fame, but also Justin Brierley, the host of the show, Brian Broderson, pastor there at Calvary Chapel, J. Warner Wallace, of course, our dear friend, and Mary Jo Sharp, also a good friend, A.J. Roberts from RTB, Reasons to Believe. That's just part of the lineup. So it's going to be a good conference on Saturday as well. $15 for Friday night. There's some charge for Saturday. I don't know what it is. You get them together, you get a break. But go to unbelievable.live, www.unbelievable.live, and then you get all the information. Also, last chance, just to let you know that on Saturday the 12th, I won't be at the Unbelievable Conference because I'll be at the Veritas University National Apologetics Conference in Gardena, California. I don't know of any other time in the South Bay of the Los Angeles area they've had an apologetics conference. Have you? I'm not even familiar with this particular group in Gardena. But if you go to conference, make that Dubs, right? You go on and you conference.v as in Victor, E as in Echo, S as in Sam, .edu, then you'll get the information about that. I'm speaking on the story of reality. I think my slot is in the afternoon. So, but there's more that will be there as well. So just letting you know about that. Now, I told you, I began to talk to you a little bit last time about my time at George Mason University, and in particular about the conversations I had with some of the questioners, the challengers, which invariably come to the microphone after a presentation. I had talked about the story of reality, and I think it's a great opportunity to speak both to Christians in the audience, which the majority were Christians as far as I could tell, and to non-Christians in the audience in the minority, because the story of reality is meant to correct, it's meant to give the big picture. It's meant to correct misunderstandings that people have about the Christian story, as it were, and it is meant to fill in holes that resolve apparent problems, like the apparent problem of evil that Christianity faces, and the apparent problem of religious pluralism, and the audacious claim that Jesus is the only way of salvation. So how can that be? So both of these are problematic, generally speaking, for Christianity, or at least it seems that way, unless you know how the story goes. And once you understand how the story goes, you realize that the problem of evil is not a problem for Christians the way many people think it is, even Christians for that matter, because our entire story is about the problem of evil. Do you ever think of it that way? If there were no problem of evil, we wouldn't have any story. It starts in chapter 3, right? And it doesn't get solved until 66 books later. The whole story is about resolving the problem of evil, how it started, who started it, who's responsible, and the mess that it caused, and cleaning that mess up. And by the way, God didn't start it, and he didn't cause it, but he's cleaning the mess up. And that's the good news, all right? And the bad news is we caused it, and we're culpable. We are liable. We are guilty. But the way God cleans it up is not to make everything right now, but to save the bad guys now and then make it right later. And so right now, when he makes it right, it's going to be a complete job, right? So when Jesus returns, we used to say this, it was like good news, bad news in the Jesus movement. Good news, Jesus is coming back. Whoa, great. What's the bad news? He's mad. So as C.S. Lewis put it, when the author walks on the stage, the play is over. So when Jesus returns to deal with the problem of evil and straighten things out, he's going to do a complete job. Right now, that's judgment, by the way. Right now is the opportunity for mercy. So this is all part of the story. And of course, when you get to the cross part, God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection, those are the five words that represent the outline of the story of reality. The resurrection, in this case, being the final resurrection to reward or judgment, you know, the beginning and the end, and everything important in between. when you get to the cross part, you know, that's when you see, you realize that there's a reason why Jesus is the only way of salvation. The reason why he's the only way of salvation is because he's the only one who solved the problem. Nobody else did that, and nobody else could. Without Jesus, there would be no forgiveness. If Jesus didn't pay for us, then we pay for ourselves, and that would take forever. So once you get the big picture of the story of reality, things that seemed problematic fit together nicely. Singular problems, the problem of evil, often have singular solutions. Jesus of Nazareth, the only way for salvation. So here I'm laying this out at the university last night. I've been there once before about 6 years ago. Not sure what I talked about. But, you know, 6 years, most of the people that were there then are gone. they move on. It's a nice thing about students. So I could use all the old jokes. Nobody knows that I've used them last time. In any event, so it was satisfying to be able to lay this all out. And but then time for Q&A. And last time around, I told you about a person I called Bob who had come up to the microphone and then raised a kind of a challenge regarding the idea that on our view, on my view at least, that children who die, say through abortion, end up going to heaven, and that's a great good. So why don't we just allow people to abort their kids because this just gives them a fast track right to heaven? And my response to him, if you recall, had to do with the nature of means to ends and moral decision making. Just because your end seems to be a noble or a good one, getting people into heaven, it doesn't mean that the means that you're using to get them there is a morally acceptable means. And murdering innocent human beings is not a legitimate witnessing technique, okay? Not to God. That's the one to whom we have to answer. And so the questioner was simply, Bob, was just simply a kind of thinking merely pragmatically, whatever accomplishes this great end must be okay. But biblical morality is not pragmatism. It's divine command. That is, we do what God tells us to do, not what necessarily we think is best. Now, it's okay to do what you think is best in the absence of other directives. In this case, we've got one. It's wrong to murder. And there's no question biblically that taking the life of an unborn human being is the same as taking the life of a born human being, because there's no difference between the born one and the unborn one in God's eyes. And I've recently written about this, and you go to Luke chapter 1, and when Mary greets Elizabeth, John the Baptist in Elizabeth's womb jumps for joy in the second trimester because he's in the presence of Jesus, who is a zygote at that point. But there's Jesus and John, the same ones who we know by that name after they were born. All right, so there's your biblical argument if you want against abortion. So anyway, that was that conversation. But there was more, because after the formal part of the event was over, Bob came up to me again wanting to ask a whole bunch more questions, which, to be honest with you, I really didn't want to do for a couple of reasons. And I had mentioned that sometimes when people want to ask questions, it isn't always to get answers. It's to parry with you. I call it hopscotch. You know, they just want to bandy about. They want to clash swords and fence with you a little bit, you know. Now, of course, they think they're right and they think I'm wrong, but this isn't really a pursuit of truth. This is just like an intramural of sports, and I'm not really into that. Sometimes I'll play along because people are listening and there's going to be benefit to the rest of the crowd, whether it's on radio or to an audience. But now there's no audience, and it isn't so much that I'm got to perform before an audience. I talked to a lot of people one-on-one. But in this particular case, I didn't think one-on-one was going to be helpful, and I didn't want to spend the little time that I had left that evening trying to you dance around fencing with this young man I'm calling Bob. So I tried gently to dislodge myself from him, and he made a kind of a parting shot. And he said, well, there's no soul anyway, so none of this matters. Now, I guess he meant that the heaven and hell issue is moot since nothing survives the death of the body anyway, which, incidentally, is just an indication that he's merely sparring with me, not in a realistic way. He doesn't believe in a soul. So whether anything or anyone goes to heaven or hell when they die is irrelevant to him because he doesn't believe in a soul, so there's nothing to go to heaven or hell. And this is why he's just dismissing me, you know, since I was trying to move on. Yeah, well, whatever. But see, this is a very, to me, this is a very strong claim. There is no soul. And those of you who followed the tactics game plan know that the person who makes the claim, what? Bears the burden of proof. So I'm not going to just let him get away with that. I did say that I didn't want to pursue the conversation much further because I had people that were waiting to chat with me, but I just couldn't let that one lie when he says, well, there's no soul. No evidence for the soul is what he said. He says there's no, well, and let me back up. He said, first of all, there's no soul anyway, so none of this matters. And so that's when I said, and this is a Columbo 2, the second question, what makes you think there's no soul? I was turning away, saying goodbye, and he fires this out, and I turn back and said, what makes you think there's no soul? And he said, well, there's no evidence for a soul. I have heard this kind of statement generally applied to Christian things so often, it drives me nutty. And here's why it drives me nutty. People say there's no evidence for something. There's no evidence that Jesus existed. There's no evidence that God exists. There is no evidence for the soul. Well, that's a bunch of nonsense. And what I mean is that it is not, there's no intellectual integrity in saying that. Now, it may be that whatever evidence that's provided is not satisfying to a person and is not persuasive to them, and so they're not going to believe it. Okay, I get that. Everybody's got to make their own assessment. But that's different from saying there's no evidence. So here we got the whole 98% of the world believing in something for which there is no evidence, God, according to this. And you have all of these people believing in Jesus, that he existed and did these things, and there is no evidence. So all of these scholars who study ancient Near Eastern history and biblical studies and the times of Jesus, and I don't mean a bunch of Christian professors. I mean anybody who studies that period of time. Bart Ehrman himself made this statement. He is no Christian. He's hostile to Christianity. He writes books against Christianity. He's either an atheist or some kind of agnostic, but he used to be a Christian and he ain't no more, and he's trying to persuade people not to be it. But when somebody asked him a question at an event that he was speaking at, I've got the YouTube thing of it. I've watched it a number of times. I got the whole text. I'm topping it out. Basically, he says, yeah, don't talk like that. Jesus didn't exist. There's no evidence for Jesus. The fact is, he said, there's not a scholar on the planet, in any university, in any city, in any country on the planet, he says, who studies this period of time, who believes what you just said. I've written a whole big book about Jesus. It's my specialty, he says, because of the evidence. The evidence is good. You have multiple sources. They're independent sources. You have eyewitness accounts. You got all this. So he's given this great apologetic, at least for the truth of the existence of Christ. So I digress here on this point. But yeah, there's another one. Oh, there's no evidence for Jesus. Really? That's the mythicist. Come on. And this guy's now saying there's no evidence for the soul. Listen, everybody knows they have a soul. You know how they know it? They know it because this is the thing they are most in touch with their entire life. Their conscious awareness of the world around them and themselves is a function of their souls. And there are all kinds of activities that they engage in that are soulish activities that are not in the slightest way physical. I'm thinking right now. My thinking produces thoughts. Thoughts have propositional qualities. They do not have chemical qualities. They are not governed by the laws of physics. They don't extend in space. My thoughts have no weight. They are not physical. But my mind is full of them. My thoughts aren't in my head. Your thoughts are not in your head. There's nothing in your brain like that. There's blood and gray matter in your brain. That's it. Your thoughts are in your mind. They are not physical. And a whole host of other things, gazillions of other things. So when somebody's, and if I had the time, I could have pursued that with him, but I didn't want to. I was kind of caught between different obligations. And like I said, I didn't want to pursue, I didn't think it would make any difference to him. But it was so stunning to me, since I've done a lot of work in this area, and I know that the evidence is overwhelming. I mean, just start talking about NDEs, near-death experiences. A person dies. Now, it isn't that a person dies and thinks he goes to heaven, and you can say, well, he didn't really die. He's still in there. I'm talking about when he's no longer in there and he's out a block away looking at something that's happening. And then when he gets revived 10 minutes later, he tells you what happened down the street. And then they go down the street and check it out, and it was as he said it was. This is called remote viewing, by the way, and there are gazillions of highly established examples of this. They are veridical. They are demonstrably veridical. That means they're true. So this is another evidence for the existence of the soul, because the body's lying there in the OR, right? But the person, he's down the street watching something going on. So in any event, I could have gone into that, but I wanted to press on another issue, and maybe the way I responded will be instructive for you. Because here's, instead of jumping in with some of those reasons, I followed my game plan by asking a question. And here's the question I asked. Remember, he said there's no evidence for a soul. And I said, tell me, what arguments for the soul have you considered but found wanting? What have you read about the mind-body problem? And that's what we're talking about here, the mind-body problem. Now, he looked at me blankly because it was clear he'd never looked into the issue at all. And then he said, well, people believe in the soul only because it makes them feel better. And I told him, I said, look, I've done a lot of work in this area. I have a master's degree in philosophy of religion and ethics, okay? I've read quite a bit of material on this issue. And I told him, I have never once heard someone say to me that the reason they believe in the soul was that it made them feel good. Never. A whole host of other reasons they gave, but not that one. Which goes to show, and here's the lesson, here is a guy declaring that there is no evidence for the soul when he has not spent a moment to consider what evidence people thought was there for the soul. Now, when I asked him what arguments he'd considered and what he read, that left him speechless for a moment. And like I said, I could have launched into a series of reasons for the soul, but I just didn't have the time. So what I did is I recommended J.P. Moreland's book on the soul. And J.P. has written a number of books on the soul. Anyone that he's written that has the word soul in it is a good one. In fact, I got a little handbook I was just reading on the airplane as we were landing today, just brushing up. And it's a RZIM pamphlet on the soul. Can't remember the exact title that JP had done for Robbie's organization. But I recommended he read one of JP's books if he was really interested in considering any evidences for the soul. And to his credit, he wrote down JP's name and about the soul, and you know, apparently he'll look it up. I don't know if he will, but he wrote it down. Now, he wanted to continue to press me on some other things, though. He says, I have a lot of questions for you. But like I said, I don't think they were really questions. They were just sparring, you know, jousting matches, whatever. But it was the end of the evening. The others wanted to talk, and I signed their books. And it was very clear to me that he would have happily monopolized me and my time for the rest of the night. So I had to let him know that I needed to move on. But I did offer this parting bit of advice, and here's what I said to him. I put my hand on his arm because this is going to be a little chastisement, and I didn't want him to think that, you know, I was really running him down or anything, but I just put my hand on his arm, and I said, look, let me give you a piece of advice. Don't say that there is no evidence for something like the soul when you haven't taken any time to look at any books that give evidence for the soul. Okay? And that was the end of our conversation. Anyway, it's time, high time I take a little break here, and then I'll go to my caller. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason.
Have you ever wondered how Stand to Reason is able to produce fresh, accessible, and relevant content each week? As a nonprofit ministry, we rely on generous supporters in order to provide the tools and tactics you need to be an effective ambassador for Christ. If you've benefited from this podcast or any of our donor-provided resources, including apps, blog posts, articles, or short videos, consider making a financial contribution to Stand to Reason today. When you visit str.org/donate, you'll find a newly renovated transaction page that makes it easier than ever to show your financial support. It has been an honor providing you with a host of free resources over the past 25 years to help you give voice to the Christian worldview. Please help us to continue on into the next 25 years by making a gift today at str.org/donate.
You know, if you've gained anything from listening to Stand to Reason, I'd really be thrilled to hear it from you. I love to take your questions, of course, but I also want your feedback. So here's what you can do. Head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating and a review. That kind of thing really helps us to get the word out so more ambassadors for Christ can find the show and become equipped to stand confidently. And you never know, I might just give you a shout out on the air to show you my appreciation for your positive review. I value you as a faithful listener. I look forward to reading what you think about the show. Thanks. All right, Greg Kokel here, back with you, and Chris is on board, ironically, with a question about the passage I was reading today. Hi, Chris. Was your question stimulated by the fact that I said I was reading it, or was this what you were going to call about anyway, and I just happened to have read this today?
It was actually what I was going to call about.
See, there it is. There it is. I just said, you probably heard me say that. So uncanny, I read it, and people ask me about it. So what's on your mind?
Okay. Well, I didn't get to hear what you said about it.
Okay.
But yeah.
My point was that whenever I read something, it just seems like within a day or two, somebody asks me about something that actually relates, this passage related to. And I was just reading in 1 Timothy the last couple of days. And we had a caller last hour that we went back to that. So anyway, this is what your question is too, right?
Yes, on 1 Timothy 4.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually part of a discussion me and two other coworkers are having. And one's a Catholic, one's actually a Hebrew root person.
Uh-huh.
But we were going to discuss this passage, and my original understanding was like people would depart the faith, you know, the apostasy, like in the latter days.
Uh-huh.
And then reading it again, it seems as though people will lose the correct notion of faith and follow like stipulations that have been added to the faith. You know, now they're, you know, prohibiting marriage or mm-hmm. prohibiting certain foods.
Right.
So not necessarily they're losing their salvation, but now they're kind of adding stipulations that take them away from what true faith is.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I wanted to pose to you.
So you want to see what I think about that?
Right.
Okay, let me just read the passage so everybody's up to speed here. It says 1 Timothy chapter 4, and yes, I just read this yesterday, I think. The Spirit explicitly says, Paul writes, that in latter times some will fall away from the faith, okay? That is apostatize, okay? And paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons. By the way, it just occurred to me the reference to deceitful spirits could be a reference to Gnosticism, which is a perverted form of Christianity that gained a lot of momentum in the second century, mm-hmm. that in which people would have angelic visitations of sorts that and angels would, spirits would give them inside info, okay? So he might be referring mm-hmm. to that. 1 John talks about it a little bit too. But in any event, understood broadly, deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons. And then he says, by means of the hypocrisy of liars, seared in their own conscience as with a branding iron. Now, I take that to mean that the ones who are falling away are falling away from the faith because they are taken in by false and deceptive doctrines,
right,
that Paul characterized in a very dark way as doctrines of demons. Mm-hmm. And the ones that are leading them astray are liars whose conscience is seared. And then these are people, then he gives some characterizations, who forbid marriage, advocate abstaining from foods, which God has created to be gratefully shared in by those who believe and know the truth, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so there's kind of the situation there. I think what's being described here is not some Christians who are just get confused on a few things. I think this is genuine apostasy. I think that these are people who are part of the fold, for all intents and purposes, visibly part of the community of the faith. And then false teachers come in, and they pull them out. They cause the shipwreck of the faith of these people that are part of the community, and they teach these odd things. Incidentally, in 1 Timothy, there's a couple of places where Paul tells Timothy, don't get caught up in silly little discussions about things that don't matter. Verse 4, right, chapter 1, okay? Don't pay attention to myths and endless genealogies which give rise to mere speculation. And then there's another, later on he says the same thing, you know. I think it's maybe in chapter 5 or 6. But so there is a problem in the church there with people teaching goofy stuff. And there's a problem in the church nowadays with people teaching goofy stuff. And I think what right. ends up happening is people who are not well-grounded, okay, they end up getting taken in by this, and they are pulled out of the community, and they go off on some kind of crazy foolishness. And he just gives some examples of that foolishness in verse 3. But there's a lot more. So does that help you at all, or was there more to your question?
Yeah, I mean, there's several passages where, like, Paul actually talks about food. You know, it's kind
Colossians.
Of a theme in there, you know. So it kind of makes me ponder on that and then think of, like, you know, different movements that say, you know, we should only eat kosher or something, or we should only eat vegetables.
Well, there's certainly no
reiterated.
Yeah, well, there's certainly no biblical reason for that. It might be a personal preference or a health concern. People might say it's best to eat kosher because it's healthier, or vegetables because it's healthier, or whatever. That's even questionable as far as I'm concerned. But there's no biblical reason to. Jesus wasn't a vegetarian, you know,
right.
And there were some things in the Jewish law that proscribed certain foods, but Jesus has since declared all things clean.
Right.
So, because it wasn't what goes into you that defiles you, it's what comes out of you that defiles you. So, I'm not sure why. To me, you know what this is? It's just like if you have some friends who are Christians, identify as Christians, but are making a big deal about this. This is an example of paying attention to myths and at least genealogies give rise to speculation rather than furthering the administration of God, which is by faith.
Right.
You know, these are one of these goof. Why are you getting off on these crazy things? We have clear statements to the contrary of what they believe. So why are you straining at these gnats?
Right. Okay. And I guess the other part of, like, that question is, I know you said that you did believe it's a complete, like, falling away from the faith, you know. I don't remember where you stand on as far as, like, one can lose their salvation.
Right, eternal security kind of thing, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, if they're regenerate, you know, obviously that's not the case, but
well, here's
how
what,
would this tie in?
Yeah, my view is that John says as much, that those who fall away demonstrate that they weren't really one of us to begin with. There are different kinds of belief. There is belief, and then there's belief. There's a shallow, empty kind of belief. just like Jesus said in the parables of the sower, you know, it's
right.
Receive the word with joy, but afterwards there's no root. Mm-hmm. And so they get clogged by cares of the world and produce no fruit. So mm-hmm. there are people who, for what seems to us to be the believers, but then they fall away, they leave. Now, mm-hmm. then the question is, well, were they ever believers in the first place, or did they lose their salvation? My conviction is, from other texts, that the miracle of regeneration is irreversible. It's
right.
a transformation, and it manifests itself in obvious ways over time. But if a person falls away and leaves, that is evidence that they never were regenerated to begin with, and maybe they had no root, or to use Jesus' terminology. What I'm looking at here in 1 Timothy 4, then, is I'm looking at, he's saying, in the church, there's going to be apostasy. So I see, I'm thinking of progressive Christianity, for example,
right.
a lot of left-leaning Christians who are caught up in all kinds of things except the gospel.
Right.
So these are people that look like Christians for all intents and purposes to a lot of people, but after a little while you realize what they end that where they're at. They look like us. That's the idea of sheep's clothing. They look like us.
Mm-hmm.
They'll say a lot of the same things that we say, but inside they're wolves. Why are they wolves? Because what they do, Jesus said this, I think, in Matthew 5 or 6, he said they promote unrighteousness. So if you have people who say they're Christians and they're promoting homosexuality and they're promoting licentious sexual behavior or fornication or whatever, or they're promoting abortion, wait a minute.
Yeah.
These are not gray areas, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that is the kind of falling away, I think, that Paul is talking about here in chapter 4. And incidentally, it's not just in 1 Timothy, but he repeats it in 2 Timothy. And then chapter 3, in the last days, difficult times will come. Now, here he's talking more, I guess, about the general population. Men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, etc. But he does say in chapter 4, the time will come when they will not, speaking here of believers, they will not mm-hmm. endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance to their own desires and turn away their ears from the truth and turn aside to myths. So, you know, that happens in the church. It's happening now. And
yeah.
I just take people that that take their exit stage left, so to speak, as not ever have been real Christians to begin with, or else they would not have left Christ,
mm-hmm.
the real one.
Yeah.
Make sense?
Yeah, makes sense.
All right.
All right.
Okay, Chris, appreciate the call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All the best to you. Bye-bye now. Let's take another quick break, and I have some more things to share with you, just finishing out my thoughts about my time at George Mason University. That coming up on Stand to Reason.
Did you know Stand to Reason has a YouTube channel? We release a new video each Monday on the topics you care about. Through short, engaging videos, our speakers train you on tactics, offer apologetics tips, answer common theology questions, and address big issues in the world today. Join tens of thousands of other subscribers so you can stay up to date when we release a new video. Just go to youtube.com and search STR Videos, all one word, and hit the subscribe button. That's STR Videos. Take advantage of this free resource to help you stay informed, encouraged, and equipped as you share your worldview with others.
Would you like Greg, Alan, or Tim to come speak at a location near you? If so, just send a quick email to darcy@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address, from a biblical standpoint, topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To learn more, just go to str.org and click on the training tab at the top of the page.
All righty. Back to George Mason University, because I had more than one questioner. A lot of them were Christians and, you know, identified themselves as such, but then had genuine questions, much like the callers to the show here have questions, even though they know the Lord. But the very first person up to the mic, though, wasn't Bob. It was Marcel, and that's his real name. I don't think he's listening to this show. But I met him right when he came in. He was a big barrel-chested black guy. In fact, I thought he was a football player, and he's about 6'3". I mean, he's massive. And I said, "Do you play sports? Are you on the?" I said hi to him, shook his hand, told me his name, and I said, "Are you on the football team?" He goes, "No, man, I don't want to mess up my pretty face," something like that. So he's really jocular, and we bantered about for a little bit, and then it turns out that he is like a representative, or maybe even the president of the student secular organization, something of that effect. And I asked him if he was a Christian, and he said, no. I said, "Oh, okay, no worries." And so, in a sense, I wasn't entirely surprised when he wanted to ask a question, though. During the talk of the story of reality, he was not that attentive. Now, this tipped me off a little bit. He sat in the second row off to the side a little bit, so he wasn't dead center. But for a large portion of the talk, he was doing stuff on his phone, and I don't think he was taking notes. Or he was just dozing off. But once the Q&A started, he was the first one to bound up to the microphone. Now, I like Marcel. He was a lot of fun. And we, like I said, we bantered back and forth and whatever. But he came on pretty strong with his first. He actually had two questions, but I think I'm just going to focus on the first one. And it had to do with the material. So he was listening enough to raise a question about what I had said, one of my biggest concerns with what I call matterism is, and matterism is the view of reality that only matter exists, also known as materialism. And as I described this competing view of reality, a view that competes with Christianity as a view of reality, and also described that on the Christian view, there are two kinds of things in the universe. There are visible things and invisible things. There is matter and there is spirit. Material and non-material things, and both of them are completely at home in our worldview. So in a certain sense, the world actually is kind of magical. And by contrast, from the atheist perspective, it's just meat all the way down, right? There's no souls, there's no God, there's no miracles, there's no heaven, there's no hell, there's no deep morality. Now, that's the way I put it, because that's the way I think it is. One might conjure up a right and wrong for themselves or for their group. That's relativism. One can believe in right or wrong because they've been tricked by evolution to do so. But in all those cases, you've just got a mind-dependent right or wrong. That is, the rightness and the wrongness is dependent on the beliefs of the individual who believes it. That's it. It tells you nothing about the way the world is. It tells you nothing about the objective world. It only tells you about the internal subjective world of subjects. That's why they call it relativism or subjectivism. And so as I described these two worlds, these two competing stories, I then described or mentioned, here's one reason why I don't think that took it further than that. I said it stronger than that. I said, here's a reason why I'm not the least wise tempted to believe in the materialism view of reality. And that is because one of the most salient or obvious features of reality that everyone knows, no matter when they lived or where they lived, they know that something is wrong with the world. This is why people bring up the problem of evil so much in its various forms. Things are not the way they're supposed to be. However, this overwhelmingly obvious feature of reality cannot be accounted for on a materialistic view of the world. And this is what I told them. I'm telling the audience, right? To put it kind of simply, you can't have a way the world's not supposed to be, the way people see it, unless there is a way the world is supposed to be. And you can't have a way the world is supposed to be without a supposer, okay? The one who determines what is the way it should be. And in my characterization of the story of reality, I mentioned that when God made the world, he made it just the way it was supposed to be. Everything was just right. It was all working together just so. It was in perfect harmony. All the parts and all the people and all the things, everything was just right. Until something happened and the world got broken. And that amounts to our explanation for the problem of evil. But in the materialistic, atheistic view of reality, there is nothing like that. There is no sposer. There is no God over all things that is making things the way he wants them to be and determines how they should be so that they should be some way. And when somebody violates that, then it ain't the way it's supposed to be, and that's the problem of evil. So put simply, if you're an atheist, materialistic atheist, there cannot be any problem of evil, even in principle. It's incoherent in that worldview. So this is the point I make, and I stand behind that. As I said, you can get a relativistic morality. You can't get the kind that matters. You can't make sense of the concern that most people actually have about the world, what is wrong with it. And so what Marcel did is he raised that issue. He basically says that diseases, for example, like rabies, are bad. Everybody knows this. This is the point he's making. Now, they came about through a very natural process of evolution, he points out, but they hurt and they harm people. So even though I'm a materialist and an atheist, I'm perfectly justified in saying that these things are bad. So, therefore, I can make sense of the problem of evil, even as an atheistic materialist. Now, I'm sure that many of you listening here can immediately see the problem. It's the same kind of problem I run into all the time whenever atheists try to argue that they can get objective good and bad without God. And what I said to him is, you have not shown us how materialism can explain that the world is not the way it's supposed to be, which is the way I characterized the broken world, which is an accurate characterization. I think that's a standard way that people think about it. I told Marcel that all you've shown is that the world is not the way you like it to be. That's got rabies and disease. You don't like that. Those things are bad to you and maybe to other people. But the things that you don't like might very well be the things some other person really likes. Maybe not rabies, but, you know, something else. And by the way, even if nobody likes rabies, that still wouldn't make rabies objectively bad. That is, bad in itself. It would only make it subjectively bad, not liked by all people. Those two are entirely different things. And so I explained to him, and we went back and forth a little bit, but this is kind of a sum of it. I explained to him that all that he said is that materialism cannot account. All he said is that materialism can account for relativistic morality, which no one, certainly not me, is going to take exception with. But I'm not talking about what people like or don't like. I'm saying that everyone in the room knows that the world is not the way it's supposed to be, whether people like it or not. Their concern here, then, is about transcendent morality being violated, and all that you've offered, Marcel, is an example of relativistic morality being violated. In other words, your personal preferences being violated. So, I said, so you actually agree with me, then, that materialism cannot produce objective morality and therefore cannot account for the problem everyone here is aware of, the problem of evil. And to his credit, he nodded, I think a little bit unwillingly, but it became clear that his objection was personalized and relativized. That's what bad is to him. But that's not the problem. So he was forced to concede my point before the entire audience, and that's always a bit satisfying when you have a challenge like that. Let's go quickly here to Jacob in Georgia. Hello, Jacob.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm doing great. My question to you was going to be, in a Calvinist worldview, how does prayer relate to that? I mean, with such a high view of God's sovereignty and everything being declared from the end from the beginning, how does prayer, can it affect God's plan or will for the future?
Okay, well, the way you put the question, it sounds like you assume that Calvinism or the Reformed view, I mean, I don't know that I would call myself a Calvinist, but I'm certainly Reformed. I mean, Calvinism entails more than Reformed theology. It entails John Calvin and all the things that he happened to believe in. It sounds like you assume that Calvinism is the same as strict determinism. And if everything is mechanistically determined, then what possible role could prayer have? Is that your assumption?
I guess so. Yes. I'm actually reading a bunch of books on Reformed theology right now, and I'm trying to make sense of God being all-knowing, and with Him being all-knowing and declaring events to occur before they come to pass, does our prayer affect those outcomes?
Okay, let me speak quickly to that. I just have about four minutes here to go, because that's a little different situation. That's focusing in not on God's sovereignty, but on His omniscience. And so the question that you're asking is, if God knows everything that's going to happen, does that suggest that things are determined to be the way they're going to happen, and therefore prayer makes no difference? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, that's more accurate. Sorry.
Okay, fine. Well, this one's fairly easy to deal with, and the answer is knowledge of something does not cause the thing to happen. Let's say there was a creature that had no power at all, had no ability of any kind to effect any change, but had perfect knowledge of everything that was going to take place. Well, it's clear that the perfect knowledge that this being had doesn't cause anything to happen, because he has no causal power. He just have knowledge of what's going to take place. The question is, why are the things that he knows are going to take place the way they happen? The answer is they are going, well, the answer I would give, I guess one way is that everything's physically determined. That would be one answer. But it also could be that it's not determined at all, that what determines any particular situation is our free choices that people make. So I'm going to make a choice to go into my Ford F-150 and drive home, you know, and, you know, maybe I might change my mind and go to get a burger, first or something like that. But notice I could do either because it's my choice. Whatever it is, though, that I freely will choose to do, whatever that is, in an undetermined kind of way, an omniscient being will know what that's going to be.
Right.
Does that make sense to you so far?
Yeah, it's making sense.
Okay, so I haven't touched on the issue of prayer yet. But I just wanted to clear this thing up first. Whatever eventually happens, it is not the knowledge that causes it to happen. Some other things cause it to happen. Some individual making free choices, all right? Now, when it comes to prayer, what prayer is us asking God to do something. Now, he knows what he is going to do, just like he knows what we're going to do. But it might be that the reason that he is going to do what he's going to do is because we asked him to do it. Even though he knew in advance we were going to ask, and he knew in advance that he was going to grant our request, that knowing in advance doesn't make anything happen. It is our request of God that factors into God making his decision to do something in the future.
Okay.
So prayer matters even when you have omniscience.
Okay. I'm following you. I guess something that would entail was, does God have, since he has the knowledge, do we actually change his mind, or does he have the outcome that he, does the outcome already predetermined to be there?
Well, I would not use the word predetermined. I'd rather say, if God, does God change his mind or not? You know, or does he have in his mind what he's going to do and he doesn't change it? And since I've got only like 30 seconds to go here, I'll just say that that is a more complex question. Because on the one hand, given the character of God and his omniscience, it isn't that anything will catch him by surprise such that he'll say, oh, I didn't realize that was going to happen. Now I've got to establish a new course of action. That's not the case. But there are times when circumstances do influence God to do one thing rather than another. And so it gets a little tricky trying to unravel that and understand how we are to take those circumstances. I think some of them simply mean that God has decided that in one set of circumstances he'll do one thing, and in a different set of circumstances he'll do another. So when we pray, that's that different set of circumstances that what it appears to do is change God's mind. But God had a resolve regardless before that. Anyway, you can chew on that one as best I can do right now in short time. Thank you, Jacob, for the call. Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give him heaven this week, friends. Bye-bye now.